So the precept is not to be possessive of anything, to be generous. And let me just start by saying that I am a total failure in this area. I am possessive, and I'm not, I think my possessiveness has gone down, but I think I was trained, as many of us, I was conditioned to regard this is mine, don't mess around with it, whether it be the car or whatever it is. And particularly, I've been a contractor for many years, so tools, please, if you want to use my tools, ask. Sometimes people on the job get a little loose about these things. But I want to relate to you that I recently sort of received a little bit of an amazement moment. So my teacher of many years, Paul Disco, the fine temple and tea house carpenter, built a lot of the buildings at Zen Center and did many, many wonderful projects. So he sort of is, he's pulling back from construction. He's having physical problems. But I went into his old shop and he moved away, he moved to Hawaii. I went into his old shop and all his tools were there, all his hand tools. They did his, hand tools to a carpenter are sort of like a toothbrush to another person. You just, they're yours. They're like part of you, your chisels, your hammers, your saws, especially Japanese style. And he had walked away from all his tools and they were there on the wall. I was completely shocked. These are tools that he had been carrying around for 40 or 50 years and using daily. And he just walked away from them. And I said, oh my God, there's a teaching here. There's a lesson here. But I do feel like most of us are conditioned and trained to regard things as mine. I don't, it's, I think I'm part of that. But also possessiveness isn't just about things. I think we can also be possessive about not just stuff, but also about identity. We can be possessive of who we are, which is goes back to the to what we were talking about a moment ago, about being puffed up. So, and I just want to put out the seed to you that being puffed up about our identity, I'm an important person, you better walk around me. Is a no-win situation. It's like a lot of possessiveness has a short-term gain and a long-term hazard, that in the end, what it creates is suffering because then we're always defending who we think we are. And so it takes us back to what Iyakima said to us years ago about be nobody and go nowhere. Very fine teacher. But I want to talk a little bit more actually about possessions. So an experience that I've recently gone through is one of our boys, one of our sons, lived in Pacific Palisades, and the house he was renting and all his possessions burned down. Everything was gone. And he's a kid who's very particular about his possessions. He's very good at building things. He likes very fine things. And he was devastated. And it was all compounded by the fact that he did get out with some papers and passports and things like that. And then everything that he got out with was stolen that night from the car. So it was like a double whammy. And he was devastated. He was traumatized and he was devastated. Everything, the house was right to the ground. There was nothing left, all the things he had built. And this is a kid who, when he was a little kid, he customized everything to his taste. When he would get these little remote control cars, he'd go up to his room and modify it and change it, make it just the way he wanted to make it. And that's the way he was about his stuff. And everything was destroyed. But when I talked to him a few days later, he said, I said, have you gone shopping? Do you have clothes? He said, no, I'm still basically wearing what I had when we left the house, that afternoon. And he said, you know what, Dad, I have no desire for things. I'm not interested in owning things at this point. And his whole attitude toward material possessions has been amazingly altered in these weeks since the fire, since January, since the fire in Pacific Palisades. And the other thing that is interesting to me about this is that he has matured in a way. You can, when you talk to him, there's a deeper presence, there's a deeper understanding. And I think to me, it has to do with the suffering that he went through when when they went through this destruction of all their possessions. So this being possessive, trying to and being generous are like so many things in the Dharma that it brings to our attention. We realize that when we thought at one time, the more stuff I can get, the better off I am. We thought that our houses, when we those of us who have houses, that our houses were the ultimate sort of seemed like the biggest possession we could obtain. And then we realize after a while that in fact we don't really own our houses in the way we thought we did. And then in fact when at some point our houses own us and will be owned by someone else, or they will own someone else down the road. So that things are not as they seem. And that's sort of one of the major points of Buddhist teaching, is that the things are often not what they seem at first look. And that applies to status. It applies to stuff. It's like what seems like a great gain at one point in your life, at another point in your life can turn into a burden. Everything changes, and that's one of the things we realize as we go along, that that great status we had when we, got this super possession or this great job or this great title, that at some point, when maybe at the other end of our career, turns into a burden, turns into something that makes life more difficult for us as we try to shed it, try to walk away from it, but are unable to do so or struggle with it. So I think the message to me about being possessive is that it's dangerous territory and that we all need to be careful about what we embrace. Suzuki Roshi said to us on numerous occasions, he said, and this sort of echoes to me, he said, the most important thing is to know how to enjoy your life. And then he said, and not to be fooled by things. And I remember that a lot. And I think by now, most of you have learned, you've been involved with the Dharma long enough to learn to be cautious about what you wish for and to realize that that everything you think you own, in fact, you don't own, or you own in a different way, or what seemed like a tremendous asset might even turn into being a liability further on down the road. So to be aware how things change. And of course this precept presents to us the antidote to possessiveness. And I think it's one of the brilliant aspects of Buddhism that it says, well, if you want to deal with your possessiveness, if you want to ameliorate your possessiveness, that generosity is a really good way to do it, to practice generosity. And it's curious, interesting to me that in many of Buddhist teachings, when it says this is how you should behave or this is what you should do, generosity is often first. And I think one of the reason that generosity is first is because generosity is a great place to grow your practice, and it's also a great place to get rid of stuff. It op generosity opens us. It frees us. It overcomes self-protection, overcomes possessiveness, overcomes the sort of closed mind that this is mine and don't touch it mentality. But like everything else in the precepts, the big question is to pay attention to how does it feel? Because when you start to feel a certain way about it, about a behavior, you'll either like it and then encourage yourself to express it, such as in generosity, or perhaps you'll feel the opposite. You'll feel like, oh man, this really makes me uncomfortable, and I want to change my behavior. And that in that case, some action will follow in that direction. Generosity in Buddhism is generally thought of in different levels. And the basic level, the most basic level of generosity is thought to be things, maybe even with that money. Not to say it's not valuable to give things away and doesn't have a great benefit to people to give away money, but that's the most basic level. The other two levels, and sometimes they're interchanged, but I'll talk about them in the way that they're often presented, is the second level of generosity is dharma, to be able to give away the dharma, to be able to teach the dharma. And of course, we all, there was Norman talked about the other day. I thought this great. He said, always, it wasn't specifically about the dharma, but could be applied to the dharma, about always teach the dharma and when necessary, use words. I thought that was very, very helpful. But the third level to me is, for me, and is included in the Dharma, is I think the greatest gift that you can give people is the gift of fearlessness. And the Buddha, of course, when you look at Buddha images, when you see the Buddha, one of the hand positions, the mudra, is you'll see a Buddha with one, the right hand usually palm up and the left hand palm out. And the left hand is saying the translation. When you see Buddhas and see statues in museums or at sittings or Green Gulch, that the left hand is saying, "Don't be afraid." The right hand, when it's open, means gift giving, but the left hand means don't be afraid. And whenever I see a Buddha image with the left hand extended out, palm first, it always gives me a good feeling. Gives me the feeling that there's some entity out there that is thinking about how we all are most generous and most ourselves when we're not afraid. And of course, there's the notion in Buddhism of dividing things into the giver, the receiver, and the gift, that realizing that every interaction, every exchange has a certain capacity of giver, receiver, and gift, and that there are different forms to give people. And I thought it would be useful for me to offer you a few examples that I've come across in my years of practice of how to deal with possessiveness and how to express generosity as a part of the process of opening yourself up and letting go, which of course is what a lot of practice is about. And I wanted to say that some years ago, a priest, a young priest that I knew at Zen Center said to me, and it's always stuck with me, he said, "I'm a greed type, that I tend to be greedy. That's just who I am." And he said, "But the way that I work with it is that I work for a nonprofit where I'm a fundraiser." And I thought to myself, what a skillful way to use his deep feeling of greed that he was conditioned to feel in a useful way for other people, for the common good. So someone's sending me, okay, anyway, and I just thought that was a very skillful way to use the feeling of greed to give it away. And you can do that. I find myself sometimes I do that with recycling. I come across objects. I walk a lot in a wilderness area near where we live, and I come across beer cans and all kinds of things. And I figure, well, I'll pick these things up and put them in my pocket, and I'll recycle them. And it's sort of like a good way to use your collecting impetus for the common good. In Japan, in Japanese, there's a concept called intoku. And intoku is defined as good done in secret, like a secret Santa. And intoku is another way that helps us grow, that helps us to be bigger people by doing something without merit. You know, that it's not necessary to get recognition. Getting recognition is just another way to, it's another form of greed. Oh, did you see me do this thing? So doing a good deed without recognition, I think, is a very, very useful way that we can grow. And another one that I came across some years ago, well, actually, I was talking to a monk in Southeast Asia, and we were talking about the notion of God. And I said to him, I said, "Do you believe in God?" And he said to me, "You know, whenever anyone asks me if I believe in God, my answer is always yes." Now, at the same time, maybe I didn't believe in God a minute before, and maybe I don't believe in God a minute later. But I'm trying to, when I say yes, I'm trying to respect that person's faith and trying to encourage faith and not be discouraging toward faith. And I just thought that was a very useful way to be encouraging to someone else's faith. It was skillful, it was smart. That to believe in, when I'm asked, do I believe in God? Yes, the answer is yes. And actually, I've tried to model that. And the minute before and the minute later, well, we can talk then. And just pointing out that generosity, one of the great foibles of generosity, is that generosity without wisdom can be a big problem. We don't give people who are addicted, we don't give people who are addicted drugs, although there's a whole debate about that that I won't go into. But that wisdom is called for in generosity. And realizing that everything you say has an effect. Everything you say can encourage or discourage. And to just be aware of that and realize that you can be generous at every moment in your relationships with other people. Maybe generous in a smile, maybe generous in a kind word. Last week, Frank Ossisesky came to our Berkeley Sangha on the internet. And he talked about a form of generosity that really sort of reverberated with me. And what he said is that when a person is sick and perhaps dying, they're very vulnerable. And that one of the things that something that the people with the dying person or the sick person can offer a gift. And the gift is a gift of stability, of calmness. And that the presence of the person that is with the person who's dying is hugely important in the frame of mind in the person who is dying. And I thought to myself, what a beautiful way to think about helping people to offer the gift of stability to someone who's sick or dying. So I think the answer is like, or I think basically what I want to say is that, as all the precepts, the first thing to do is to see ourselves and see our behaviors, to avoid condemnation and self-criticism that doesn't go anywhere and is not useful and is not wholesome, and to work with the feeling of the behavior in all the precepts. When you express a certain behavior or certain words, how does it feel? Does it feel like you're being generous? Does it feel like you're being encouraging to the other person or people you're talking to? So are we being supportive or not? And if you let yourself feel the feeling at that moment when you're interacting with others, that you will know what to do. And being generous is a natural quality, and we all have it. It's just a matter of getting to the feeling and being generous. So I think that's what I have to say. Thank you.
Shall we take just a minute of silence between the talks?
Yes, please. Let's do that. Thank you, Alan, for that very nitty-gritty in the real world discussion of this precept. We appreciated it. I've been thinking of this eighth of the clear mind precepts in the most simple and straightforward wording, also not to be possessive of anything, but to be generous. And this is such a huge topic, really, that I don't think we can really even scratch the surface or the surface of the surface of things that we could talk about, but we can, begin or continue our thinking about it and discussions. Of course, one of the first things that occurs to me is how familiar this territory, as Alan pointed out, is to all of us. We all intimately understand the feeling of mine, this belongs to me. And we also all understand the many ways in which we give, the things we can give, the emotional support we can give, as well as the giving of our life energy, and of the work that we do. I think in some ways, the act of giving is really the essence, right at the core of practice, of our practice. When we give, we cross the boundary between self and other. We erase the boundary. We realize that there is a boundary and there is no boundary. The great bodhisattvas have compassion, which is universal and every bit as much for others as for oneself. The great bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara has perfect compassion, always constantly available to give herself to ease the suffering in the world. We humans do not have such compassion. Therefore, we train, we practice compassion, and we practice generosity as a way of training ourselves to be aware of and to actualize our interconnectedness with everyone and everything, and ultimately to allow us maybe someday to embody the oneness of all being. In the meal chant that we say, that we just said during Sesshin, we say, may we all realize the emptiness of the three wheels, giver, receiver, and gift. The emptiness, that is, there is a giver who is no giver, a receiver who is no receiver, and a gift which is no gift. There is nothing but giving, nothing, as Norman always says, nothing but compassion and love. Our individual compassion is cultivated by acts of generosity. Whenever we give gifts, we may receive in return gratitude. We may receive love in return. Also, we instantly feel the liberation associated with giving. We understand in the act of giving that nothing is actually possessed by us. And we're freed from the suffering that's associated with believing that we have things that really actually belong to us, that we can give to others. For all of these reasons, acts of generosity reinforce our desire to do more of the same, to give more away to the world. So, what are some of the things which we give, which can be given? First of all, there are material objects, including money, of course. When I take a dollar out of my wallet to give to a street person, I think of this as my dollar. And as I pass it along, I'm practicing the ultimate reality that we can't really possess anything and that we share everything. Here's what the scholar Dale Wright wrote about giving money. Money is the easiest and most effective commodity for giving because recipients can cash it to pay for whatever is truly needed. relieving the donor of the responsibility to understand fully the complex and always changing needs that the gift hopes to address. Money is not just another thing, it is our symbol of things, and in that capacity has extraordinary contemporary prominence. Money symbolizes the power of abundance and the security of our relations to the larger world. To give it requires a clear sacrifice on our part. Giving money so that others might procure what they need, we sacrifice some of our capacity to have what we want. It should also be said, and this is me, not Dale Wright, it should also be said at this point that the size of a monetary gift does not matter. What's most important is the intention behind it. Here's what Dogen says. Even if we give something humble, a single penny or a stalk of grass, it will plant a root of goodness in this and other ages. What else do we give? We may give our physical labor, our time, our energy, and volunteer capacities to do some good in the world. And to tell the truth, whether we give our time and energy in volunteer capacities or in a paid occupation doesn't really change anything. Our work is our gift, an expression of our generosity in the world, paying back the gift that we have received of this life and of everything that supports us, the myriad things that support us in our life. Here is what Dogen has to say about this in the fascicle, The Four Embracing Actions of a Bodhisattva. Earning a livelihood and managing a business are nothing other than giving. To launch a boat or to build a bridge is the practice of dana paramita, the practice of perfect generosity. Some other things that we give. We are constantly in the position to give the great gift of recognition to other people, to look someone in the eye, to smile, to listen attentively and with your heart open as other people speak. These are great gifts that can change a person's day for the better, or their next minute for the better, or their life maybe for the better. This kind of support that we have to others, to offer others, may be a casual interaction in a cafe, or potentially life-saving attention to someone who is suffering badly under the weight of loss or personal failure or a disappointment or just some vague anxiety that might be crushing to them. Dale Wright says the ability to register another person's pain and to communicate to them the feeling of our understanding and care is a very important skill in the practice of generosity. Here is Dogen again in the Bodhisattva's Four Embracing Actions, these amazing words. We offer ourselves to ourselves, and we offer others to others. Whether we give or receive, we connect ourselves with all beings throughout the world. We offer ourselves to ourselves. In other words, we allow ourselves to be in the moment as we are, to be our true selves, not our narrow selves, but to be as open and as free as we can be, to hold the Zazen posture, to be upright, still, aware, open, to be loving, is offering ourselves to ourselves. And to offer others to others is to attend to others with open receptivity and attention, allowing others to be as fully themselves as possible. In Buddhist thought, as Alan mentioned, there are three types of gifts: material things, dharma, and fearlessness. During Sesshin and in our seminars, we are all incredibly lucky to receive Norman's teaching, which supports our practice. This is such a treasure. People will pay thousands of dollars to go to a Broadway show to have some deep, meaningful experience, something that touches them at the deepest levels of their heart. And here we have such riches so close at hand. Learning to sit still and pay attention to our breath and body and mind enables us to limit our suffering and the suffering of others. Spreading the word to others, enabling others to do this very simple, very intimate, and most available practice is one of the great gifts that we can give. And the gift of fearlessness. The myth of Shakyamuni speaks to this. When Shakyamuni determined that he was going to understand reality and the end of suffering, he sat under the Bodhi tree, determined not to move until he was fully awake. And he was attacked by Mara, the force of delusion. Mara is the mythic representation of all of the energies that throw us off, that undermine us, that throw us off our game, our intention, our deepest intention. The most powerful of these forces in the myth was the assertion by Mara that Shakyamuni had no right to believe that he could do this, no right to believe that he had the wherewithal to end his own suffering. Who did he think he was, anyway, to believe that a lowly being like him could end his suffering, no less to carry out this task? In the myth, Shakyamuni touched the earth and asked the earth to attend, excuse me, and asked the earth to attest to his right, his power to carry out his inmost and most important desire. And the earth supported him and shook in six ways to show it. And Shakyamuni was encouraged. Encouraged, as we know, literally means to take heart. I'm very intimately familiar, as many of us may be, with the undermining, insidious, and destructive nature of feeling like I'm not good enough. The gift of fearlessness speaks to this insidious, corrosive quality that might assail us. My teacher, Steve Weintraub, likes to often point out to the scene in On the Waterfront. Some of us here, I know, are old enough to know this reference. Marlon Brando in On the Waterfront, Brando famously reciting the lines, "I could have been a contender instead of a bum, which is what I am." The power of another human heart to relieve a person of such a literally heartbreaking belief is rightly, I think, the greatest gift and that can be given, literally a life-saving gift. So I think I'll stop there and leave you all with Marlon Brando and the gift of our practice, the power of our practice to convey that fearlessness, that we can sit upright through everything. that might come to assail us. We all have that power. So thank you very much for listening, for being here. I think we are going to break up into breakout groups of pairs. We'll pair people for today's meeting. And Alan and I hadn't discussed specifically what we would send people off into the breakout rooms with, but I had thought, just to the role of giving generosity in your lives. What are the gifts that you give? What are the gifts that you receive? How do those things act in your life? How do they affect you? What do you notice about the role of generosity in your life? Alan, do you have anything you'd like to?
I would just broaden a little bit to say, what's the what are the feelings that you've experienced? How did how when you've done something, you've been generous, or how does it feel? And at the same time, perhaps if you want to talk about it, how does it feel to be possessive? Just because I think that's how we change, is to be aware of how it makes us feel. And that's the wonderful thing about the practice, is that you don't, this is, we're not trying to force anything. We're just trying to feel what we feel and go from there.
Great, great. Thank you, everyone.